The exact building is this, we're organizing this workshop, which and let me also thank the Rishi Kanoda for really like the whole beautiful experiment in stone organics. A friend's email to me suggested that I give some sort of, spend some of my time reviewing the theory that's pertinent to the organics, so I thought I'd do that.
You want to speak?
The audience might. what I thought would be most useful to do is to talk about the theory that's pertinent to the organic experiments, but in particular highlight those aspects of the theory that require more scrutiny and things that we should be discussing over the next several weeks. At least to me, that would have been the most useful, so I decided that that's what I would do. So my involvement in this field doesn't produce all these papers, so let me highlight some of the younger people, starting with Patrick. So William Bichak Kremper is a grad student of Yongbae Kim. He spent a summer working with me. Puyan Gaemi is a former student, now a postdoc at Illinois. Andrew Porter, who's sitting there, is a student at MIT with Patrick. Maitham Barkashley is a postdoc at Stanford again. And David Bross, who's sitting there, is my student. And Karen Grover is a former student, currently postdoc at the KATP. So I'm not really going to talk in detail about any of this work, but it's work of this sort that led me to the perspective that I'm going to present today. So by now we have a list of seven materials which look like good candidates for liquid systems. In addition, there are newer ones that Leon will probably tell us about at some point, quantum spinites, things of that sort. So of this list, these first three, empirically, are all close to pressure-driven Mott transitions. So they are what we call weak Mott insulators. They are not in the too strongly correlated regime, while these other two are on 2D Kagame lattices, they're far away from the Mott transitions. We call them strong Mott insulators. These may very well require different kinds of theory. Okay. So far in all the experiments, all these candidate materials, there's essentially no magnetic ordering down to the lowest measured temperature, or at least the temperature is much smaller than the natural exchange scales. There's an exception, which is this Volvo-Thayer Kagame system. It orders at 1 Kelvin or so, but the G is about 85 Kelvin. But even though it orders, it still continues to do interesting things. So, for instance, it has linear T heat capacity and so on. In fact, quite a sizable linear T heat capacity. But in the experiments, in all these systems, this gap of segregation is down to temperatures much, much smaller than the natural energy scale, which is J. And this was extensively studied in these organics with a J, which is of the order of 250 Kelvin. One dramatic example is something you saw in Kanoda's talk. It's thermal conductivity of this DMIT member of the organic family, the DMIT spin liquid. And this large residual thermal conductivity that was reported in this experiment, which is a very striking sign that it's gapless mobile excitations in this insulating material which doesn't have any magnetic ordering. So that's an exotic phenomenon, right? Okay. So what about theory? So in theory, we know of many, many different kinds of spin liquids, quantum spin liquids. They can be gapless, they can be gapped. And just like there are many, many different kinds of magnetic ordered states, There are many, many different kinds of quantum spin liquids, and there are several people in the room who are engaged currently in the process of classifying some of these different spin liquid states. But hopefully that program will reach fruition soon. But pertinent to this talk, the comment to make is that the microscopic conditions that favor one or other of these spin liquids is still not understood in general, and the best that we can do is to make some rough guess. So that's one area where we definitely need to have more to say in the future. So what kind of rough guesses can we make, right? In the absence of being able to say, given this material, this is the model, and this is the kind of spin liquid it's going to be, if at all it's a spin liquid. So one guess that we can make is by using this distinction between weak and strong Morton insulators, which empirically is a distinction that one can make. So in a weak Morton insulator, you might expect that the short distance physics is still that of a metal. And metal, of course, the spin carriers are fermions. So you might reasonably expect that in a weak Morton insulator, which is insulating at long distances, that you end up with a gapless spin liquid with fermionic spin-on-like excitations. On the other hand, if you have a strong Morton insulator with well-developed short-range magnetic order, where at short scales it's basically a magnet, but at long scales the magnetism is somehow destroyed by a combination of quantum fluctuations and frustration or something of that sort, then we might reasonably expect that you get a gap spin liquid, perhaps with bosonic spin excitations, if at all it goes into a spin liquid phase. So this is some rough criterion that I think is useful to keep in mind. But having said that, I should immediately point out that exceptions to this rough insight exists. The Kangmei experiments, if not in the theory, at least in the experiments, the Kangmei thing, the materials are gapless, even though they are strong Morton insulators, and we very well have short-ranged antiferromagnetism of some sort. But this is the kind of thing that, this is what we can say so far. So I'm going to specialize to weak Morton insulators, and let me make put down a list of questions that, as theorists, we should be thinking about. So how to think about these quantum spin liquids in weak Morton insulators? So more generally, is there a theoretical framework that we can use to start thinking about a gapless spin liquid anytime it shows up in an experiment? Equally importantly, perhaps even more importantly, it'll be good for us to be able to answer the question of exactly what will be the most meaningful experiments for any particular spin liquid state. That we, if we think that some material is in some particular spin liquid state, what's the most meaningful thing that you can measure that will reveal that that's what's going on and not something else? We want to understand existing experiments. And finally, the very existence of a spin liquid on the Mott side of the Mott transition gives us the hope that we can understand a Mott transition between a Fermi-liquid metal and this kind of Mott insulator. So there's an opportunity to make progress on the old problem of the Mott transition once we accept that spin liquids exist. So in the last few years, we've got very good answers to many of these questions, but clearly we're nowhere near full maturity. There's lots of different things that we still don't understand, and in particular we don't understand to a large extent the existing experiments. So clearly there's enormous room for new developments in theory. So let me talk about some of the ideas that we can use to try and understand these spin liquids in a weak Morton insulator. So one approach is to start from the insulator if you think in terms of a Hubbard model with a T and a U, then a weak Morton insulator means that T over U is not too small. So if T over U is very, very small, you can start the use of perturbation theory in T over U gives you a spin Hamiltonian, which is order T squared over U, just nearest you know, SI dot SJ. But as CoU increases, there'll be more terms in the Hamiltonian, and a particularly interesting term which shows up at that potential in the tau dot K to the 4 over U cubed is 4 particle ring exchange, which cyclically exchanges these 4 particles. So one approach to studying the physics of weak Morton slaters is to study Hamiltonians of this kind and see, attack them numerically and see what we can learn about what they might do, which models without the string exchange, just the nearest neighbor two particle antiferromagnetic exchange, don't do. Right? And that approach has actually led to dramatic progress starting in prehistoric times in this exact dialization work that Gregor Nisbet was doing. In the context of these organic spin vectors, this approach was pioneered by Lessig-Motronetsch with variational calculations for this the ring exchange Hamiltonian. And most recently, Lessig, in the company of Donna Sheng and Matthew Fisher and so on, had done explicit DMRG calculations on this model to understand that, and demonstrated that it goes into a particular kind of gapless spin liquid. Right? So ring exchange is good. Right? So that's the one lesson. And the other lesson is that in the terms of the string exchange, at least on the triangular lattice, it seems like what the numerics gives us is a gapless spin liquid with, for instance, the DMRG calculations with many, many gapless points in momentum space where the spin correlations are poor law-like. Right? So it's reminiscent in the 2D lattice of a full surface or in momentum space there are gapless spin and singlet correlations. So one issue, so yesterday Steve White raised this question of connecting numerics to analytic theory. So one issue that comes up in the context of these numerics is that so far, what this body of work, and particularly the DMRG work, has shown is the answer to the zeroth order question. Right? So, is there a Fermi surface like gapless state? Right? The zeroth order question is there a spin liquid, and that's the answer is yes. And next, what kind of spin liquid? And it turns out that it it's a state that looks like it has a Fermi surface. So the next level of question, I think, is to ask whether the state is really a non-Fermi liquid of the kind that we expect, a non-Fermi liquid of these spins, of the spin-ons, of the kind that is expected from the effective field theory of, of these spin liquid states that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. Right? So my understanding is that so far that numeric has not been able to access that question. Right? Perhaps Matthew or any of the DMRG people can correct me on that.
I'm afraid you're right. This is my
good question.
Yeah, but for the future.
This ring exchange is well motivated by being near the Mott transition, but does not have to be. I mean, couldn't there be other mechanisms by which a highly insulating material also has biquadratic or ring-like exchanges?
I don't know of other mechanisms for ring exchange. If you know of something, let me know. I'd be very curious.
Well, I mean, if T over U is order 1, which it typically is, even though you may have a reasonably big gap to charge excitations, why couldn't there still be?
No, T over U is order 1, probably on the metallic side or
very close to it. Well, order 1 means I'm saying bandwidth over U is order 1.
Yeah.
Which is typically the case.
Right. So
there might still be a fairly well defined excitation to a gap to charge excitation, but there may be reasonably significant ring exchanges.
Yeah, so to some extent, doing the CoU perturbation theory, you know, that's what, once this number of, you know, 60 over U, whatever that.
Thinking about experiments, because many of the experiments keep showing us gapless spin liquid. Mm-hmm. Is this a...
Well, I see what you're saying. Maybe a strong Morton slater in terms of a measure of the charge gap, But microscopically, it may not be that strong a Morton slider.
What is it? I mean,
meaning microscopically, in the phase diagram, it's very close to the Mott transition.
Not necessarily very close to the transition, but somehow I'm saying microscopic parameters are all order one, typically. You don't have U much, much bigger than the bandwidth.
I think what you mentioned may precisely happen at sort of helium 3 films, where you have some strong collective motion of the atoms generating some significant ring exchange for the spin degrees of helium. Mm-hmm. But still, it's impossible to put two atoms on the same side.
Yeah.
Charge fluctuations are negligible.
But it's still close to melting of the solid. But, so, in that sense, it's close to the analog of the Mott transition. Yeah, but I see your point that the true measure of whether or not what we really need is the steel volume to be not too small to get ring exchange. Now that may not translate into a small charge gap. Sure, I agree. Yeah, you know, so there's a strong first order transition. Then you may very well have a big charge gap, but still be a reasonably not too small TOU. True. That's you.
I don't know, just empirically, it's looking at J as a maybe better indication than trying to guess TOU. Well, obviously, that's correlated with that, but I mean, if J is well below the charge gap, I mean, well below a few orders of magnitude, then.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
To see how, you know, it's not like it could be a weak model as well.
Right. Okay, so the point that I was going to make was that for the future, you know, as people talk about things for numerics to shoot for in terms of making contact with other things, with effective field theory, you know, trying to address non-Fermi liquid, the putative non-Fermi liquid physics of the 2D system by doing a 1D De-Morgy calculation looking at intermediate scale physics, I think is a goal that's worth working towards. At least I would be really interested if to see such progress. Okay, so let me talk about the effective field theory a little bit. But before I do that, since Shivaji mentioned quantum Hall yesterday, I felt that I had to take the quantum Hall route and talk about wave functions. So let me very quickly describe a different way to think about this weak spin liquid in a weak Mott insulator, which gives us some insight and also tells us how to build an effective field theory. Right? So let's start with our understanding for Fermi liquid. So the free Fermi gas describes the state of determinant wave function. And to describe a Fermi liquid through a wave function, we'll incorporate correlation through a Jastrow factor, which keeps the electrons away from each other. Some such factor like that. And a special case of this Slater-Jastrow wave function is obtained by, if you consider a lattice Hubbard model, so in a lattice Hubbard model, a popular choice of wave function is to restrict this Jastrow factor to just being something that penalizes double occupancy on the same site. And that's known as the Goetzeler approximation to the wave function, the Goetzeler wave function of the lattice Hubbard model. So this is familiar, right? So this is how we describe in a wave function approach an interacting Fermi liquid. There's an interesting point of view on this familiar fact that a Slater-Jastrow wave function describes the Fermi liquid. So the Jastrow factor is a symmetric function of all the particle coordinates. So we can think about that as a wave function of bosons. We are free to do that. Why not? So what we've done in constructing a wave function for the Fermi liquid is to take this anti-symmetric function, which is a state of determinant, and multiply that with a symmetric function of all the particle coordinates. Now, a product of a symmetric and anti-symmetric function is anti-symmetric, so this is a legitimate way of writing down a fermion wave function. So any choice of this boson wave function gives us a legitimate fermion wave function in terms of symmetry. If you choose this boson wave function to be the wave function of a boson superfluid, which, as you all know, a good wave function for a boson superfluid is simply the Jastrow wave function. So then that choice, where I choose this to be the wave function of a boson superfluid, gives me the wave function of a Fermi liquid. Right? So there's just a point of view all old and familiar facts. But now, with this point of view, we can surge ahead and describe a Morton slider. So to describe the Morton slider, let's start with this wave function of the correlated metal and simply replace this wave function of this boson superfluid that we hit the slider determinant with. Replace the Jastrow factor instead by a wave function of a localized solid of bosons. Now what that will do is to freeze out the charge motion and give us an insulator. So we now have a wave function for a Morton slider. So this product of a slider determinant and a solid wave function is a wave function for a fermionic Morton slider. So this wave function is a spin singlet wave function because all the spin physics is inherited from the slider determinant. So you might imagine that we can expect spin correlation similar to a metal, and that's roughly correct. Now, a more familiar form of this wave function is in this extreme limit in which we completely freeze out all charge fluctuations on a lattice, and that we can do by choosing the wave function of the boson solid to be one when there's exactly one boson at every site, so which then corresponds to a projection onto the subspace when there's exactly one particle per site of the original electrons. And that's, of course, the familiar Gibbs-Miller projected Fermi-C wave function, and that's now a pure spin wave function and can be tested variationally on the ring exchange models that we derive from the TOVU expansion. Okay. So the picture of the mode transition, so David Bross, my student, made this picture which I like very much. I think it's a cool picture. We all know what a metal is, right? So there are positively charged ions that are sitting still, and there are electrons that carry charge and spin that are swimming around freely. Now, in the Mott spin liquid near the metal, the picture that this wave function is capturing is one in which the charge of the electron gets pinned to the ionic lattice, while the spins alone continue to swim around freely. So it's an itinerant spin fluid in an insulator. Okay? So show this picture again later. First of all, this picture is very useful in thinking about, for instance, how phonons couple with spinons. Right? So I'll talk about that a little bit at the end of the talk. Okay. So I described this spin liquid in this weak Morton slider through a wave function through this picture. So now let me give you the formal theory that we all use to describe the spin liquid. So this is based on a slave particle representation. The slave particle representation should make a lot of sense once you think in terms of this wave function of multiplying the Fermi liquid, the free Fermi gas wave function by boson wave functions and so on. So the formal theory will try and capture the physics in a way that helps us build an effective field theory, right, which we can then use to make predictions for measurable quantities with various levels of confidence. So the idea is to write the electron operator as a product of a charge E spin zero boson and a fermion. And in this context, the mean field theory that this leads to was pioneered by Antoine George some years back. It's known as slave rotor, whatever, but it's more broadly, it's slave boson or parton mean field theory or parton construction. So the idea then is to take the lattice Hubbard model and replace it at some mean field level by decoupled Hamiltonians for bosons and fermions, put all the correlation effects into the boson, because after all, they're the ones that carry the charge, and let the fermion kinetic, the fermion just be free fermions. So in this Bose-Hubbard model, if the bosons are condensed, so then B is just a C number, and then the F simply becomes the C, and the spinon just becomes the electron, right? And you get a Fermi C of electrons. So that's very natural from the point of view of this wave function, where we were multiplying the free Fermi gas wave function by a superfluid wave function. So that's mirrored in this more formal theory by doing this product and then condensing the boson. Right? On the other hand, to get the Morton slider, we simply want to put the boson in the boson Morton slider, And that then freezes the charge motion and leaves us with the mobile spins. And this kind of construction at the mean field level, we can readily generalize to, we can let the fermions do any other thing that we like, spin density wave, BCS, whatever, right? And nothing changes in the theoretical story, nothing dramatic changes. Okay. So the fluctuations beyond this mean field, snake particle representation has this well-known feature that it has this gauge redundancy. You can rotate the phase in this way independently at different sites. So not surprisingly, this then leads to a low energy effective theory, which is described as a free Fermi gas of spinons that are coupled to a fluctuating U1 gauge field. So I want to emphasize that in thinking about slave particles, this is actually the main role of slave particle theory. It's a useful way to derive the low energy effective theory of some curative spin liquid phase. It's not at all clear that it's a very useful way to address issues of microscopic stability, though it's often used for that purpose. I at least don't have any faith in using slave bosons or any proton construction for that purpose outside of the quantum Hall effect. But this ability to derive a low energy effective field theory, which we can then use to make predictions for experiments, is that's a very powerful application of slave particles. And for other situations too, that's probably the most reliable thing that you can do with slave bosons, at least as of now. Okay. So that's what probably people are quite familiar with. So let me talk about properties of the spin liquid, of this particular low energy effective field theory. So it has a Fermi surface of spinons that's coupled to a U1 gauge field. So this problem is an old problem in many body physics. It's a large theory literature. So recently, following beautiful work by Seung-Sik Lee and Max sitting out here, it's become clear that the standard approximation that was used to justify RPA in this context, a log-gen approximation, is very problematic to actually implement. And the log-gen theory turns out to be much weirder than you might hope for. And particularly, it's not at all clear that you can reliably say anything about the physical properties of the system using just this log-gen expansion. So we suggested a way out a couple of years back, and that's to combine this log-gen with another small parameter that was introduced in this context many years back by Chetan Naik and Frank Wilczek. And then it turns out that if you do a double expansion, then there's some control calculation. The problems of unearthed by these people are circumvented, and there's a control calculation that you can do of some many aspects of the physics. Okay, but since I said I wanted to highlight issues that are worth talking about for the future, I think this is a really important issue to get to the bottom of in this field. Many of the opinions that we put forward about experiments in organics are to some extent based on our understanding of what's measured, of the measured properties in terms of this effective field theory. Right? So, as most of us are theorists, I think this is the kind of theoretical problem that's really worth getting to the bottom of. We really want to be confident that we have the right predictions from theory for what the specific heat does, what the thermal conductivity does, and so on. For some of these things, we do have, I think, the various levels of confidence, depending on whether I'm saying it or Max is saying it, or Matthew is saying it. We do have some idea of what it will do. But for something else, for some other things, we don't. So this maybe is one issue very much on the theoretical side, but it's clearly very, very practical. Where we'll hopefully see progress in coming years.
Sure. Is this a technical issue, or what do you mean by practical?
Okay, just wait till the next slide. And Okay, so Rajiv asks, what can a person like Sintel mean when he says practical? Okay, so there's the kind of properties that we can conclude. So the specific heat, this theory will predict that it goes like T to the 2/3 rather than what we might naively expect for a spin wall Fermi surface, which is linear in T. Right? So this prediction is actually a very old one. It goes back to, late 1980s, but it was challenged by Soon-Sik Lee and Max's subsequent development. So within this double expansion, there's no modification of this prediction. Equally surprising is that even though the specific heat is changed from Fermi liquid to something like this, the spin susceptibility is a constant. Right? So according to the pristine theory, the Wilson ratio will actually go to zero at zero temperature. Right? So these are things that people measure. Right? So we had better know what the state actually tells us. So these two properties I actually am fairly confident of. The thing that I'm less confident about is the thermal conductivity, which Patrick has a prediction that the thermal conductivity is not linear in T, but rather it's much bigger than linear in T, that it's T to the 1/3, at least in the clean limit where you ignore impurities and so on. So this has not been scrutinized after all the recent upheaval in this field. Within this double expansion, or perhaps there's some other way to control the theory, the thermal conductivity has not been examined so far. And it needs to be done, because this again is something that people measure.
So does the double expansion also give you the magnitudes, the constant of the susceptibility as well as the amplitude?
No.
Why not?
Oh, because it's in the spirit of effective field theory. We imagine we've integrated out all high energy modes, just specialized to degrees of freedom near the Fermi surface. So then you lose a lot of microscopic information. So any non-universal thing we can't calculate. But we are at a stage where even the universal things we have difficulties with.
It's possible that you have A times T to the power 2/3 plus B times T, and A is much, much smaller than B.
Yes, and so if you don't worry about...
That's a practical issue.
That's a practical issue. So I'm saying there's an even lower order practical issue that we're still worrying about. What you say is, of course, another next level practical issue. In this particular context, for the specific heat, we can make a guess as to what the coefficient is. Dimensional analysis will give you a guess. And you can try to do better, right? But how reliable those are, we don't know. Again, maybe in the distant future, if someone can find a way of numerically calculating these non-universal things, that would be amazing. But that's probably far too distant in the future. I don't know. I don't want to be pessimistic. But qualitatively, I think the results that seem to show up, or that there's this non-Fermi liquid specific heat, a Fermi liquid like spin susceptibility, and non-trivial thermal conductivity, though the precise temperature dependence. There is a prediction from theory, from simple theory. Not so simple.
In real experiment, presumably be dominated by
impurity.
There is a low temperature limit.
Yes.
So it will probably be very hard to.
So this may not be that pertinent in real experiments. So that's the next comment that I was going to make. But before I do that, let me point out one other thing which I think is very interesting and important, and because it's very qualitative. So there are sharp 2KF singularities in measurable quantities, which is the spin triplet quantity, which is just the spin density, and a spin singlet quantity, which is the spin on density. So both singlet and triplet correlators have 2KF singularities. And so seeing these 2KF correlations, it's a clear signature of a Fermi surface. Right? So later I'll talk a bit about seeing the Fermi surface, and this is one of the important things that can give us a clue on whether or not there's a Fermi surface.
So this thing about the Zorda-dominated regime,
yeah.
What is there a prediction for that?
Oh, just linear in T. So it's good. So there's a caveat to all these answers, which are in the clean limit. that below some disorder dependent scale, the properties become much more semi-liquid-like with weak corrections. So Patrick pointed out to me earlier today that it happens at a much higher temperature scale for transport, but for specific heat, even for the specific heat, the state of the two-thirds will at some point cross over to T log T, something like that, at some different scale. But eventually, if you are very ambitious or you're experimenters, you go and take an ideal sample and measure down to the lowest temperatures. If you have disorder, you'll only see semi-liquid, more or less semi-liquid-like answers. So searching for the non-semi-liquid aspects of this thing as a way to prove the existence of spin-on Fermi surface is dangerous, I think. I'll talk more about that later. Okay. So things of this sort, extracting things of this sort from the effective field theory, I think is a really, really important task. And it'll be good to know some of these things with more confidence as we go along. So let me talk about one more thing that pertains to the experiment. Again, very old days, 20 years back, it's been clear, for a long time, it's been clear that the meaning of this gauge flux density is that it's the scalar spin chirality taken around some triangular plaquette. So that's a physical operator, right? That's a product of three spins, something that in principle one could measure. So a very nice idea on the effects of this gauge flux was worked out by Lasik Motunich a few years back. So he said that an external magnetic field will, on symmetric grounds, induce a coupling to the scalar spin chirality in the COU expansion at order t cubed over u squared. Right? So this means that if you apply an external magnetic field through the orbital coupling of that magnetic field, you will see a coupling to the spin-ons by generating an internal magnetic field. So an external orbital magnetic field will generate an internal orbital magnetic field for the spin-ons, right? Which then gives you a probe of the spin-ons, which is very different from any of our usual probes. Right? And on symmetric grounds, these two, the internal field and the external field, are expected to be proportional, and common sense will tell you that this number increases to 1 as you approach the metal. Right? So the metal, these two numbers should be the same. But in an insulator, we don't know exactly what this number is. In fact, we have no clue, really, what this number is. So there's one of those non-universal numbers that we don't know. But one implication, if this number is not too small, one implication is that a magnetic field applied perpendicular to the layers may have both orbital and Zeeman effects. Right? And so if you could see a difference between in-plane and out-of-plane fields, then you know that there is some orbital effect on an insulator, right? Which is very striking. And a striking example of a prediction one can make is this thermal hall effect of Katsura, Patrick, and Nautanagos, a prediction for a possible thermal hall effect in these organic spin liquids. Now this paper has been subjected to has been used as a weapon to kill the spin-on Fermi surface state. I should point out that the estimate made in this paper assumed that this alpha is basically 1, and that's optimistic. Right? So the idea with this kind of an experiment is that if it's seen, it's great, you know, it rules in the theory. If it's not seen, you can always escape. Right? So not seeing the effect is not a very strong argument to kill the spin-on Fermi surface. I'm sure Patrick will agree with that.
When you say orbital, when you say orbital field, you just mean something that couples to the phase, the usual gauge.
Yeah, exactly. It couples to the spin-on as though it's a real magnetic field. It, the spin-on is neutral, right? So it's not supposed to do that, but it does. And in particular, since it's order t cubed over u squared, you know, as t over u decreases, this number drops rapidly. Okay. So, yeah.
In Brugmann, Lasik Martinich, did the estimate value of alpha based on some variation calculation?
Yeah, he did. And it gives sensible answers that, as you increase the strength of ring exchange, it increases in some way. So one of the state that's pertinent to what I'm going to say is that if this, so one thing that could happen is that the spinons, instead of forming a Fermi surface, pair into a baseless condensate, and that's a Z2 spin liquid. The spin physics of that state is, will be very similar to that of the corresponding superconductor, and it'll have Z2 vortices and things of that sort. Okay, so on with all this theory, let's think about what may be going on in the experiments. So one common sense thing to say, based on whatever I've said so far, is that as you increase G over U, if the conducting state that you reach from the insulator is a metal, then common sense demands that the corresponding insulator has a spin-on Fermi surface. While if the conducting state that you reach after the Mott transition is a superconductor, then common sense would demand that the corresponding insulator is a paired spin liquid. Right? So based on, you know, the metal and superconductor are very easy to distinguish from each other. The spin-on Fermi surface and paired spin liquid, perhaps not so, right? So we can start guessing, you know, which system will have the spin-on Fermi surface, which system will be paired at low temperature. You know, it's a guess, right? So we can't put money on it, but we can at least guide experiments. So let's apply this intuition to experiment. So just the phase diagram of the Kanoda's material. So the function of pressure, so at ambient pressure, it's a Mott insulator, it's spin liquid. As a function of pressure, at higher temperatures, it goes into a metal, at lower temperatures, goes to the superconductor. So a natural guess may be that at somewhat higher temperatures, above 5 Kelvin or so, that this Mott insulator, given that empirically it looks like a spin liquid, has a spin-on Fermi surface. But that at low temperature, something resembling what happens to the electrons in the metal happens here, and then there's a pairing instability of the spin liquid. Right? And indeed, as we saw in the last talk, there is a low temperature instability in kappa ET, in the kappa ET spin liquid at ambient pressure, and the temperature scale, 6 Kelvin of that instability, is comparable to the TC of the superconductor. This is 3.5 Kelvin, so it's roughly the same scale. But not exactly the same, but it's roughly the same. Anyway, so that's, I think, a common sense point of view, which may or may not be right, but it's at least the first thing that one would say. On the other hand, in this DMIT spin liquid, under pressure, there is no superconductivity, at least down to the lowest measured temperature, which is 1 Kelvin, which suggests that this DMIT has much weaker pairing tendency, and so the natural guess may be that if at all this instability is there in DMIT, that it's suppressed to much lower temperature. Indeed, that seems to be broadly consistent with what we know from experiments. So the crucial question, in my opinion, in this entire business, is really to prove through experiments that there's a Fermi surface in the Mott insulator. Right? You know, thermodynamic measurements can give us hints, but really, if you can prove there's a Fermi surface, measure the Fermi surface, that's really striking. So what can theory suggest? So here again is a question where I think, you know, there's many ideas that have been generated, but all of them are extremely hard things to do. So it'd be great to have more ideas, you know, maybe one of them will work. So the first idea is to use this unusual orbital response to look for quantum oscillations in applied magnetic field. But Lasik Martinich actually did the theory far too well and convinced himself that this probably will not be seen because of domain formation, where the system locally separates into integer, you know, a commensurate filling with a magnetic field, condoned domains.
That's who tried up to 40 tests, I think.
He doesn't see anything, exactly. since Lysak, who sort of did not predict this effect, he said this effect is interesting to consider, but it's probably not going to be seen. So I guess his negative prediction probably that. So another interesting idea, again very, very hard to implement, is to do a JMR type experiment where you take two ferromagnetic metals, separate them by a spin liquid buffer, and look for oscillatory coupling between these ferromagnets driven by RKKY type interactions. Very hard because you need atomic precision for the spin liquid buffer. Right? But apparently some heroic people at Argo are trying to do this with the iridate, so hypercadmium iridate. Maybe it'll succeed. You know, it's good. If people have money, why not try crazy things? Yeah.
Just on the first one, I mean, you should know, but I mean, in the experiments, is there data on the metallic side under pressure of the quantum oscillations?
Converters material there is, but the Fermi surface looks sort of different from. There's such high pressure that this the electronic structure has changed in some way. Should we call the house? Anyway, so the short answer is yes.
But the Fermi surface doesn't load.
I thought the Fermi surface has done quite, has changed in some way.
Under pressure?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the metallic
state.
In the metallic state.
In the
ET. Have they done quantum oscillations?
Quantum oscillations, yeah. In the Fermi surfaces,
it's a circle.
Circle,
yeah.
It's
just circle, okay.
Yeah, I remember dependent boundary resistance and stress shows that they're
single quantum
surfaces.
Mm-hmm. 2D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you don't see the Shubnikov de Haas oscillations, and it's for this domain formation reason, is there a way to see the domain formation itself?
Good question. I don't know. Certainly, what's seen, at least the Kappa ET, is that the system, as you saw, becomes very inhomogeneous. Now, is that inhomogeneity the same as this? I haven't studied the issue
what's
myself.
The nature of the domains?
You fill an integer number of Landau levels in each domain.
A different number of Landau levels?
Yeah.
So spin-on density is changing.
The spin-on density is changing.
Also, in the morning, the field dependence of this inhomogeneity wasn't very strong. So,
in-plane field
behavior, same. That is true. That's a good point. So, it's not the same. It's not this effect. No, but this effect relies on that alpha, this fudge factor alpha, being order one, right? You know, how much internal magnetic field you get from the external magnetic field. If that's, you know, 0.1, then it's a different story. Right?
Not to flavor this, but if you have inhomogeneous spin-on density, don't you have to overcome the knockout to have inhomogeneous electron density?
No. You need that if it's varying, and if it's slowly varying, right? If it's sharply varying, you don't need that. The Morton layer is incompressible for long wavelength density deformations, not for short wavelength.
Constraint is not in force or effective.
Yeah, that's right. So there are two other ideas that we generated. One is to argue that even in the scintillator, there'll be corn anomalies in the phonon spectrum coming from the spin-on Fermi surface. And the other is to look for feed-in-like oscillations in STM. Both of these are really hard. But this effect is kind of interesting, and there's some very simple physics associated with it. So let me describe this physics in one slide. But for this general slide, I want to emphasize that more radios are definitely needed, and either from theorists or experimentalists, it would be great if somehow or the other we either know for sure one way or the other whether there's a Fermi surface in this insulator. Okay, so the corn anomaly, let me go back to my favorite picture that David drew. So So for photons in a normal metal, you know, Ashcroft moment tells us that what happens is that as the ion moves, the ion motion is screened with electron fluid, and the core anomaly occurs because of the change in the screening properties of the electron fluid as you go through a 2kF wave vector. Okay? So now in the spin liquid Morton slater, so the picture is that the charge of the electron has gotten bound to the ion to form a neutral entity, and that's forming your lattice, and the spins are moving freely. But this ion charge on composite carries this internal gate charge, and as the ion moves, this imbalanced internal gate charge, which is going to be screened with the oppositely gate charge spin on C. Right? So it's the same mechanism as screening in the in an ordinary metal, but no of the internal gate charge. And therefore, as you go through a 2kF wave vector, there'll be a change in the screening properties of the spin-on fluid, and so there'll be a core anomaly. Okay? So these 2kF wave vectors, we know, or we have a good idea of what they are for many of these candidate spin liquids. So in principle, one can try to obtain the phonon spectrum through inelastic X-ray. Apparently, neutron is very hard. So one more comment is that this core anomaly survives even in a strong Morton slater if it, for some reason, has a spin-on from the surface. So it may be useful to look for this in some of these other materials as well. And finally, what this shows is that looking at what the phonons are doing in these candidate spin liquids, it's a very useful probe of what the spin is doing. Right? And this is highlighted by a paper by, I don't know his first name, he's somewhere in the room. He's this person. Zhu and Li, who suggested looking at transverse sound attenuation and seeing it fall off as you go through the putative spin-on pairing transition. So what the picture in the previous slide shows is that spin-ons couple of phonons just in the same way as electrons couple of phonons. Right?
Is there a small parameter here like there was in the orbital coupling to the real magnetic field or no?
No.
This is really order one.
This is really order one, exactly. That's why even so in a strong Morton slater. But this kind of thing again is set of phenomena, spin-on phonon coupling. Right? So any real candidate spin liquid, that probably plays some role in some of the phenomenology. Right? So let me finally turn to the low temperature physics. This is a very messy area. Most aspects of the low temperature physics are not understood at this time. Maybe they will by the end of the program, so clearly lots to talk about here. Let me return to this phase diagram first, and particularly return to this statement that in this DMIT, there is no superconductivity under pressure down to the lowest measured temperature. So it's a very weak pairing tendency, one might guess. Let me take that seriously and ask whether at all there is a pairing instability in DMIT. So in terms of experiments, I think this is a question that's very much worth posing. So let's review what the arguments are to say that there is a pairing instability. So in the kappa ET material, we saw that there were good arguments. And the Searle's argument so that the measured specific heat at low T is linear, while the spin-on from the surface state predicts an asymptopia T to the 2/3. This thermal Hall effect is not seen. The thermal conductivity apparently is proportional to T rather than T to the 1/3, things of that sort. Right, so let me address the first issue of the specific heat. Now, at least as a naive theorist, I always assume that T and T to the 2/3 are very different. Because if you plot C over T versus T, one goes to a constant, the other diverges. Okay? Now, if you look at the data, it turns out that it's really hard to separate the two. So this is the data. This is actually the data from Kanoda Nakazawa group on DMIT. And I lifted the slide from a commentary that Todd Ramirez wrote on their paper when it appeared in Nature Physics, pointing out how subtle it is to actually extract this specific heat. So the point is the following. So somewhat higher temperature, it's all dominated by phonons, and C over T goes like T squared. Now at low temperature, it turns out there's a Schottky anomaly, and that gives you an upturn, so it goes like 1 over T squared. Right? And the thing that you want is hiding somewhere between this phonon part and the Schottky anomaly. So what Romulus did was to take their data and fit it both to this form, A over T squared plus gamma T plus BT cubed for the specific heat, and also to the T to the 2/3 form by keeping all these things, other things the same. Right? And the red line is the T to the 2/3 fit, and the blue line is the linear T fit. Sorry?
The other way.
The other way, thank you. That's important. So the difference really is...
The point was to say it didn't make any difference.
No. The point is to say that it's really hard to tell. But in this material, I think you can actually tell. Because if you look at these two curves, you see there's this little bump here, right? The red actually fits the data slightly better than the blue. I'm glad that you had that reaction, because it's really that hard to tell, right? So, okay, so we had to take this linear T, well, as, you know, not seeing T to the 2/3 is not that strong, right? So let's repeat this for the DMIT material. So David, again, kindly just took the published data on the DMIT material from Yamashita et al., Nature Communications, last year. And so this is the data at zero P, and he drew two lines through this data. One is a set of black dots, that's fit to linear T, and the black line is fit to T to the 2/3. Right? I don't know, you know, I don't think anyone can tell. Right? So at this stage, I think...
What about larger powers of T?
He didn't try that, but yeah.
You're
right. The only point to make here is that we can't conclude yet from the experiments that T to the 2/3 is not seen.
What were some of the TV?
Yeah, that's.
So in these materials, it's very hard to subtract out the phonons by having a similar.
So first, I think that's what Kanuda was saying. Though you change the material, you can try to subtract phonons to some extent, but it's quite sensitive. And then there's this upturn, right? The Schottky business. So it's sitting between this falling part and this rising part. And you want to look at some tiny difference here. Very hard. So the point is that, you know, either really fits, and we can't at this stage, it's premature, I think, to say that it's clearly linear T, so forget about T to the 2/3, forget about your gauge field, blah, blah, blah. The thermal hole effect is another popular criticism of the spinel Fermi surface, but as I already said, the magnitude is very uncertain in theory. So the very optimistic prediction is not seen, you know, not seeing it is not a strong argument. So the thermal conductivity is apparently proportional to T rather than T to the 1/3. Again, we already discussed this, but T to the 1/3 is in the clean limit. And with impurities, you could get linear T. We don't even know how solid the T to the 1/3 prediction is from the theory. And finally, we don't have enough T range to extract the exponent, I think. Because the data that this is based on goes from 300 millikelvin to 100 millikelvin. Right? Beyond that, it's dominated by something else, probably phonons. Besides, so the point is that the standard arguments in both pairing all rely on seeing these non-Fermi liquid effects of the spin-on-Fermi surface. But those things are very hard to pull out from data, and furthermore, they can become more Fermi liquid-like in the presence of disorder. Right? So using that as a criterion to rule out the spin-out Fermi surface is a bad idea. Right? Now in the kappa ET, there's clearly an instability going on, with the various pieces of evidence that Kanoda-san showed us, but in the DMIT, it's not at all clear that there's such a pairing instability. So I think this again is something to discuss, right? But maybe at the end of the day, when the dust settles, it will be that DMIT is just the original spin-on from the surface, and that's it. With real life complications like phonons and disorder and short key anomalies and things of that sort. It should be done, or?
Yeah, we can have a few minutes for questions.
Okay. Let me say one other thing, more as a confession rather than that's a claim of. So the alternate possibility of pairing the spin-on from the surface, one idea that we've explored with Tarun and Nandini Trivedi and Patrick is to say that some kind of D-wave pairing, that seems to work well for some aspects of the physics, but it has a serious problem that, so the speed independence of the low temperature specific heat, and more recently of the spin susceptibility, is a serious problem for this theory, and for that reason we can't really push this theory too hard. So at least for the kappa ET, I think the situation is that we don't understand the low T physics. Some ideas are needed. For DMIT, maybe we can, it'll just be the spin-on from the surface, but maybe there is a pairing instability, we don't know. Anyway, so that's some summary. So let me stop there.
Can you say a few more things about free associations upon implantation of a magnetic impurity in the system? That should be quite sensitive directly to local spin on density. You have a point about this.
So why magnetic? Even with non-magnetic impurities, if you're talking about the spin on density.
Yeah. Even non-magnetic.
Yeah, so the spin-on density will have 2kF oscillations.
So why is that hard to see? I mean, you have a statement, it's hard to see.
Oh, because you have to do STM to see it. And in organics, no one has apparently ever done a successful STM.
Yeah, that's it. It's an insulator.
The other thing is it's an insulator and you have to get rid of the charge. But even the conducting organics, apparently, STM has never been successfully done. Not for us to worry about.
What about magnetic impurity?
Yeah, so with magnetic impurity, there'll again be 2kF, spin cradle oscillations.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that has ever been measured in any system. In an ordinary metal, have people ever measured this 2kF? You'll probably see some broadening of the line in NMR, right?
Well, but the Condor attack, there won't be a Condor attack, right? It will be if the coupling is strong enough.
No, even if this is basically like a metal,
right?
When you go above the Condor temperature, you may hope to see something, but I don't know if that's ever been done successfully to measure 2kF in any system.
So potentially, the spin on the surface is also sensitive to spin orbit coupling, right?
So potentially.
So that if you have some sort of absorption skin area, then the spin becomes spin orbit coupling.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are various cubical zero growths. So spin absorption experiments, very simple, which can look for non trivial line shapes.
Sorry, what would that give you that can measure the
from if you have known in the other piece, right? So you do some sort of ESR, you have absorption at exactly Zeeman frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But
if there is spin orbit coupling, then this becomes non-trivial. It's not a delta function, it's non-trivial line shape, sensitive to the action of magnetic field and spin orbit axis and things like that. And you broke excitations near the spin
orbit. So can you detect the Fermi surface that way?
Yes, well, if you know something about spin orbit coupling, then you can use this in order to say something about Fermi surfaces.
Good.
The fact is, the organic field is
not this week. So in the iridate, hypercagamy iridate.
Not specifically for organics, it's more general.
Is it at all realistic for organics to see SR functions?
So what's not, I don't know what's known about the SR and organics.
For example, G-bar is nearly asymptotic. The G-bar is 2.00 something. So it's not coming to
It's, yeah.
No, but in the iridate, it may be interesting to think about. Okay. Yeah.
There is a simple reason why this spin-on firmness surface may be more relevant than this nodal spin-on in experiment. Because nodal spin-on, you can also see some like power law like behavior.
Yeah, so the conclusion that I made was about a theory with nodal spin-ons. That has field dependence of the specific heat and so on. So generally invoke impurities first to get some finite density of states. Right? And then, so you can do that. So we did that for some time. And but then if your field exceeds, you apply a magnetic field that exceeds the disorder scale, things will start being field dependent. Right? Now, in the till recently, there was field-dependent measurements of specific heat available out to 8 or 9 Tesla, and it's field-independent. Now, in the DMIT compound, there's a measurement of the spin susceptibility out to 32 Tesla, and it's field-independent. Right? So I think, we're not in a position to push any nodal state too seriously at this stage.
Last question.
As far as I understand, experimentally, the transition from either the superconductor or the metal to the periodic spin liquid is first order at low temperature.
No, so it's not that clear because that's what Kanoda was talking about towards the end of his talk. So below 5 Kelvin, you know, from the superconductor, it looks like it's first order. But once you go above that temperature, you know, above the superconducting transition, there's some, you saw the resistivity data, right? There's some change. There's some jumps and so on, but of course the theory also predicts some jumps. Like, even if it's a second order transition, there's a jump. So at this stage, you know, I think the qualitative statement that he made in that if it's first order, it's a lot weaker first order transition than in the antiferromagnetic magnetic Morton Slater. That's my understanding of the situation experiments.
From the experimental point of view, to prove the first order transitions, we should use the fluid as a pressure medium. And at low temperatures, we have to vary pressures. And then we should observe the first order transition from the insulating state to the superconducting state. But in the critical pressure of the transition in spin-related material is high compared with the antiferromagnetic materials. So at this critical pressure, maybe 4 kilobar, the period solidified. So what we can do is the pressure change at high pressure, high temperatures, and then temperatures. So only discrete experiments. So that is the reason why we cannot anything definite about this problem.
So if you go above 4 Kelvin,
maybe 10 Kelvin or
something. Yeah, so if you go to 10 Kelvin, is it what happens there?
Very sharp decrease.
Right.
Sharp decrease.
So that, okay, I mean, perhaps it's consistent with second order transition, but perhaps the first order transition, right? I think the jury is out.
Okay, that's a good note to end this on.